This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Another bailout for GMAC?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You're listening to the Morning Report for Wednesday, December 30th at marketplace.org. I'm Bill Radke. Wall Street is just beginning its day, and we're looking at news affecting the broader economy. It looks like more taxpayer bailout money is going out the door, and there's news of a possible reprieve for Saab. We'll get to all of that in a moment. First, where's Wall Street? Not much going on there. The holiday trading is light. The S&P 500 is down about 0.2%. The NASDAQ is essentially flat. The Dow is off 15 points at 10,529. European stocks are down a little less than 1%. Asian markets were mixed today. In Tokyo, shares of Japan Airlines tumbled on fears that carrier might declare bankruptcy. And Taiwan's two main political parties agreed today to reinstate a ban on some U.S. beef imports. Taiwan had lifted that ban this fall, but protesters have staged rallies over fears of mad cow disease. General Motors was set to pull the plug on Saab after tomorrow if it didn't get any better bids for it. This morning, Saab said GM has dropped that December 31st deadline and will keep making Saabs next month. How long that'll last, who knows? GM is looking to sell Saab, and so far it has not struck a deal. Meanwhile, GMAC may be getting billions more taxpayer dollars. Marketplace's Elisa Roth joins us live from our New York bureau. Morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
How much is the government going to give GMAC?
Probably around $3.5 billion. The government's already given GMAC $12.5 billion. This $3.5 billion is actually quite a bit less than the government was saying GMAC would need as follow-up help. That original number had been more on the order of $6 billion.
So why does GMAC still need money, and why is the government giving it?
Well, the most immediate problem is GMAC's residential mortgage business. It's been in a lot of trouble lately, and this new cash is supposed to help GMAC figure out what to do with that mortgage business. But I talked to a banking analyst this morning, Bert Ely, and he said there's really more to this than just houses.
GMAC is playing a key role in the recovery of General Motors because GMAC's finances not just car sales, but also many GM dealers.
Now, GMAC also plays a similar role for Chrysler, and keeping both of those car companies in shape is clearly important to getting the auto industry back in shape.
Well, how long is GMAC going to need help from its Uncle Sam?
Well, Uncle Sam has said he hopes to see a profitable GMAC by March of next year, 2010. GMAC itself is anxious to reach that, too, partly because right now the government controls how much it can pay its executives. At this point, the government owns about a third of GMAC. It sounds like it'll probably end up owning even more before all this is done, and that could be significant because it could give the government more say in how the company is run. It could eventually even appoint members of the board.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
So what do we make of this latest taxpayer rescue? Let's bring in Richard DeKayser. He's president of Woodley Park Research, and he joins us live from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So we bailed out the big banks, and they have been repaying their TARP money. Are taxpayers ever going to see this GMAC money again?
In my opinion, it's doubtful we'll see full repayment. As you said, the banks have not only repaid, but have repaid at a profit. What we're seeing in these particular bailouts is simply an effort, an almost, you could say, at all cost effort, to put a floor under the housing market. Just five days ago, the government also announced it was lifting the cap on its potential aid to Fannie and Freddie.
Mm-hmm.
And the common theme here is that we have a nascent housing recovery. It's very tentative. And the government, I think, wants to do everything it can to see that that is not stymied. So the ultimate question is, are the costs ultimately to the taxpayers in the form of the bailout more than compensated for by the benefits of a rejuvenated housing market?
Well, yeah. So what would happen if GMAC folded?
Well, in this particular case, it's ResCap, as you mentioned. It's the residential mortgage arm that was potentially going to be put on the market. Apparently, there were no good bids. If it was forced to dump it at a distressed price, that would be adverse for the housing market. It would likely result in some write-downs, foreclosures, and that's exactly what we've seen too much of. That would undermine the price stability that's just been happening in the housing market. And all told, really throw a monkey wrench into, again, this nascent and tentative recovery.
Richard DeKayser with Woodley Park Research joining us there live from Washington. Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure.
There are two more business days left in 2009. Still time for a few more banks to fail, I suppose. The total right now stands at 140 for the year. That wave of closures has sent the FDIC's deposit insurance fund spiraling into the red. Well, today, that starts to change, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The FDIC's insurance fund protects deposits up to $250,000, and it's paid for by premiums charged to banks. Today, those premiums come due, not just for a quarter, but for the next 3 years in one lump sum. Eric Oja is a bank analyst at Standard & Poor's.
They need the cash simply because the fund has diminished.
Andrew Gray of the FDIC says it's worse than that.
As of September 30th, the fund stood at negative $8.2 billion.
Gray says this three-year prepayment will raise $45 billion, putting the fund back in the black. Some banks have complained paying all at once will hurt their ability to lend. Eric Oja says that's not likely. The bigger problem is finding good loan risks in this poor economy. Plus, he says, banks got a break when times were good.
For almost 10 years, the industry paid very little or nothing in premium and got a free ride.
Small banks can request an exemption, though doing so could signal their finances aren't strong enough to survive the coming year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Russian oil giant Lukoil has just signed a deal to develop one of Iraq's biggest oil fields. The Russians won the rights to the field at an auction earlier this month, and there were very few American oil companies in the bidding. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why.
The Iraqis are driving a hard bargain with foreign oil companies. The contracts up for bid earlier this month were only for 20 years, and Iraq gets $2 for every barrel of oil the foreign companies pump. Bruce Bullock is an oil industry economist at Southern Methodist University. He says Iraq's terms were just too tough.
They wanted quite a bit to participate, and it would have been very difficult for most U.S. companies to be able to make a comfortable profit on it.
Especially when they'd have to spend lots of money for security in Iraq and to shore up the creaky infrastructure in Iraqi oil fields. Oil industry analyst Stephen Shork says the spoils of the Iraq war aren't so great.
It's going to be a tremendous cash outlay, and you know, a lot of companies are cash strapped at this point.
Their shareholders are strapped too, and they won't support risky investments in places like Iraq. In this economy, they want quick, safe returns. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Cities have been tightening their belts this year, cutting extra services. Philadelphia announced it could not afford to host the annual New Year's Mummers Parade, a tradition in that city for more than a century. The Mummers are managing to pay for the privilege to march. Gregory Warner stopped by a rehearsal in Philadelphia.
The convention hall where the Mummers do their dry run is so large I have to be driven around by cart. The driver is Scott Brown.
Each organization is given 60-foot wide space in which they can build. They have 2 days to bring in their props. As you can see, a prop can be up to 62-foot high.
Mummers like Brown contribute hundreds or thousands of dollars for their props and costumes. But last year, the city said it couldn't afford the extra police and trash collectors for the New Year's event. As Mummers director Jim Julia explains,
you know, we're closing pools and we're closing libraries. Okay, that's a legitimate argument. The difference is this. There's costumers that are in business simply because of the Mummers. Home Depot is out of plywood.
that's not true. But Jim says the parade does bring in millions of dollars more than it costs the city. Supporters launched a fundraising campaign called Save the Mummers. State politicians, business owners, and Kevin Bacon got involved. The Mummers have agreed to compensate the city $150,000 for their march on Friday. And the upshot is, after all this attention, the old Mummers no longer feel taken for granted.
The Mummers were always there on January 1st. And then last year, all of a sudden, somebody said there may not be a parade. And that's when people, we won the PR war big time.
Now, anyone for the pools and libraries? In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Housing economists have their hands full these days, trying to patch together a pattern out of opposing trends. On the one hand, sales of existing homes appear to be rising. At the same time, new home construction is way down. One part of the housing picture that remains upbeat, sales of so-called new urbanist developments continue to perform despite the downturn. From St. Louis Public Radio, Adam Allington has more.
What's a U.S. homebuyer to do? You're nervous about buying in the city with its old infrastructure, messy politics, and complex social issues, but you're not that jazzed about the idea of cul-de-sac living either. New urbanism proposes a third option: compact, walkable communities with a mix of houses, apartments, and stores. Tim Bussey is the architect behind one of the hottest new urbanist projects in the Midwest, Newtown at St. Charles.
It has continued to perform very well through the recession.
2,200 people live in Newtown, about 30 miles west of St. Louis. This small house, still just studs and drywall, is precisely what Bussey claims many homebuyers want: opportunities to downsize.
I have never in my career designed a house that's 600 square foot completely customized to an owner's specifications. And so this represents part of the future of development.
Peter Calthorpe is an urban planner often associated with the new urbanism movement. He says over the past several decades, developers have adopted a one-size-fits-all approach. All houses in a subdivision were the same size, big.
We tend to think of this housing boom and bust as a problem around credit and financing. The reality, I think, is we've been building too much of the wrong stuff for too long.
Calthorpe says there's a way to avoid selling people homes they can't afford. Give consumers more choice on smaller lots with better access to public transit. But others accuse the new urbanists of simply designing better sprawl.
You have to wonder, why are we building on the fringe like that?
John Burse is an architect with Mackey Mitchell.
Should it be built here, or should we not be concentrating our energies on making our inner city more livable and solving these tough issues that we have?
New urbanist projects account for just a tiny fraction of homes being built. Even Newtown's success wasn't enough to save its developer from bankruptcy in October, as sales of the company's other properties plunged 70%. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Somali pirates fired shots at a merchant ship in the Indian Ocean last night. No reports of casualties, and the pirates did not board the ship. This follows the hijacking this week of a tanker and a cargo ship off the east coast of Africa. And as Stephen Beard reports, it is the latest incident in a record year of Somali piracy.
They've attacked 214 ships this year and hijacked 47 of them. Ship owners have paid out ransom money reckoned to run into millions of dollars. Governments are trying to crack down. Europe, the US, China, and other nations have sent a naval task force to the region. 30 warships are now on constant patrol. Bard says Graham Gibbon-Brooks of Dryad Maritime Intelligence, that's barely a drop in the Indian Ocean.
Technically, it's extremely difficult for the Navy to patrol such a large area, specifically looking for targets that are very, very small. It would be analogous to trying to patrol the whole eastern seaboard of the United States with 30 police cars.
He says the pirates are operating further out at sea using larger ocean-going vessels. He thinks the current upsurge in piracy will continue at least until March, when the weather will make boarding at sea more difficult. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And finally, yet another use for Facebook. An escaped prisoner in Britain called Craig Lazy Lynch is using the site to taunt police. He regularly updates his Facebook page with criticism of the cops and photos of him holding a wanted sign. The police are asking Lynch's 3,800 Facebook friends to help track him down. This is Marketplace Morning Report. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.